All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.tracksfm.org.
Welcome to John Bowd's All the Rage. Welcome to an evening of splendid music and ting and ting. It's been a mad day, so I haven't got an accurate description of what John's subjects will be today, but they normally are centred around pigs and hoity-toity people, not very rich people not paying tax, and all sorts of things. But apparently, it's all right. They just tell you they're going to do it, and we just say, "Okay, John."
Yes, it's an entirely different thing. You can't accuse me of lying if I told you I wasn't going to pay. Amazing method that only the rich can manage to muster. To be honest, that's pretty much what you were. That you pretty much summed up the show quite nicely. Then I don't think I'll bother. No, this week's show is going to be the show we tried to do 2 weeks ago when we had the same microphone trouble we've actually had tonight. But I've managed to log into a different system. What I'll do, actually, just to let you know if that's all right, Dave, I might go through a couple of these things, and then I might get you to play a track just for a couple of minutes, if that's all right. Yes. Yeah, because I want to try something else, because what I'm actually doing, firstly, right, fuck the deep state trying to destroy our show by thinking you can mess with my Windows 10 microphone settings, which, by the way, are absolutely appalling. If there was any other reason to hate Bill Gates, aside from him being a psycho, it's the fact that he's produce Windows 10 with the worst microphone settings I've ever seen. That's what I'm going to say it is anyway. There's a million and one podcasters around the world now just sniggering that this silly old man can't make his fucking settings work. No, I'm telling you now, it's Windows 10. Anyway, there's that. But also, I just can't. This is basically, as I say, the show we were going to do about 2 weeks ago. The stuff that I cover tends to remain, sadly, very relevant. Basically, we're going to do one of our occasional catching up with the worker fight back in relation to various stories, hoping to shine some much needed light on the darker areas of our modern working world that in so many ways seems to get worse by the day, but in other ways seems to actually give us quite a lot of hope. But we will also highlight, as I say, a couple of very concerning issues and what they say about our wider culture in society. Okay, first things first, work is killing us. There is a story that showed up in the just trying not to press the wrong button. You should see me right now, Dave. Literally, I'm cradling a very small union appointed laptop in my left arm in order to get the microphone that's inbuilt to it as close as possible. It probably still sounds like shit. So I'm doing that whilst reading off of my main laptop because I didn't actually send myself the notes in time in order to get it onto the little one. It's quite a sight, really. It's just this is what happens when your granddad has a go at computers. Sorry, there was a show on the a story that showed up on the BBC back in May that showed a very bleak situation of work for so many today. There is new research thought to be the first study to quantify the global burden, as they put it, of disease from working long hours. That is, diseases caused by overwork. That is case studies such as people having heart attacks caused by 60-hour work weeks and similar situations like that. The paper was published on the 17th of May this year by authors from institutions including the WHO and the International Labour Organization, also known as the ILO. That suggests, in their words, according to the BBC, that each year three quarters of a million people are dying from asymptomatic heart disease and stroke due to working long hours, end of quote. Stress and high blood pressure are major factors in asymptomatic heart disease. I've probably pronounced that wrong. So in other words, or in the words of the article specifically, more people are dying from overwork than malaria. A global health crisis that demands attention from companies, governments, and individuals. If we do not solve it, the problem will likely get much worse. A paper was published in Environment International, where researchers systematically reviewed data on long working hours, defined as 55 hours or more per week. They then examined health impacts and mortality rates from most of the world's countries from 2000 to 2016. The authors also controlled, as it were, for factors such as gender and socioeconomic status, quote in that report, in order to tease out the pure effects of overwork on health, end of quote. The study, established that overwork is the single largest risk factor for occupational disease, end of quote. And that accounts for roughly one third of the burden of disease related to work. Now, here's another quote directly from the book. There are two major ways that overwork can reduce health and longevity. One is the biological toll of chronic stress, with an uptick in stress hormones leading to elevated blood pressure and cholesterol. Then there are the changes in behavior. Those logging long hours may be sleeping little, barely exercising, eating unhealthy foods, and smoking and drinking in order to cope. End of that quote. Jeffrey Pfeiffer, a professor at Stanford University's Graduate School of Business, has written about this in a book called Dying for a Paycheck, where he notes 120,000 deaths a year could be attributed to work environments and costing about $180 billion in healthcare costs. He also estimates about half the deaths could be prevented, a third of the costs too, apparently. Even The Economist interviewed him for his book, where he talked about this toxic work environment, or these types of toxic work environments. Now, again, there might be a tendency to see this as an individual problem, but it is a social one. For starters, people are not killed by work like this are likely to be severely damaged, and that means dropping out of the workforce for longer periods, possibly permanently, and needing care from public health systems. Now, many listeners might know, if you're here in Britain right now, we're having a little bit of a debate about the public health system, the funding of it, who funds it and why, which is definitely something we'll talk about at some point on the show. But that's what you're talking about. Basically, the ones it doesn't kill can end up damaging them either temporarily or permanently. Overwork is a worry, clearly, but even specifically to these times, both in COVID and as we hopefully move on from it, the pandemic has intensified some work stresses while bringing new forms of workplace exhaustion, with so many working harder and often for far less reward. Now, my next story, before I get your feedback on that, Dave, I just want to key this one in too, together, because this is the something else I've been reading a little bit about called the Right to Disconnect Law. So something else that took on even higher and more visible understanding in many people's lives over the last 18 months is the way and manner that work has taken more of our time. As we saw a massive increase in working from home, which some came to understand more as living at work. There has for some time been a problem of the inability to switch off from work in an increasingly digitalized world. Now you are often expected to answer emails in personal time, even when you're on holiday, you know, that kind of thing. You're expected to kind of always be on and always be available for contact. This technology is being used to create a never-ending work culture. It has a huge effect on mental health. One in three workers report struggling to switch off, leading to increased stress levels and burnout, similar to what we were talking about a minute ago. In France, Ireland, Argentina, and the Philippines right now, governments have taken action to fix the always-on work culture that has accelerated over the last few years, introducing laws giving workers the right to disconnect, that is protected in law, the right to turn off from work in your own time. This would mean, from a trade union perspective, if you like, a structured work time frame such as those in place in physical workplaces. Just dropping out of my notes for a second. I think this is long overdue for assessing something like this, and Dave, you might agree with it. Just let me get to the end of this and we'll discuss it. But the manner in which, you know, we've allowed these workplaces to become unstructured means that basically what we've come up with is a system where people just can't rely on actually being able to work sensible time periods and hours and actually be able to turn off. Anyway, in Ireland, there are three key elements enshrined in the code that they've come up with. The right
to... Nope. John, you've disappeared.
Not to have to routinely perform, using to attend. Oh, have you got me now? Did I? Oh, I dropped out. Okay, should I start that again then? Just the three,
yeah, go on.
3 points. Okay. So in Ireland, there are three key elements enshrined in the code. The right of an employee to not have to routinely perform work outside their normal working hours. The right not to be penalised for refusing to attend to work matters outside of normal working hours. The duty to respect another person's right to disconnect, e.g. by not routinely emailing or calling outside of normal work hours. It should be noted that the UK government has not indicated plans to make such a right a legal requirement, however, nor produced a code of practice on the rights in the same manner as Ireland and other countries have. Nevertheless, as we look to a post-pandemic world that involves more homeworking, it may be something that organisations look to explore. I think it's long overdue. The Prospect Union via megaphone.org.uk have started a petition calling for the whole of the UK to introduce the right to disconnect into law. And I'll stick the link to that in the show description later on. The UK Working Time Directive states that employees cannot work more than 48 hours a week on average, and this right would mean workers could still not be contracted outside of work in their agreed contracted work hours. Basically, this is a sign of recognising that this is an issue, if nothing else. So, yeah, those two states there, Dave. What do you make of those? What do you want to feedback on that?
Well, just on the world of work, the Scandinavian countries... certainly have adopted shorter working weeks. As you know, the CWU have campaigned vigorously and succeeded in a 35-hour week with no loss of pay. I understand Scotland are trialling four-day weeks. bear in mind that whatever country is successful at post-COVID, you'll find most people working from home. Most white-collar workers at the moment, office jobs, are being advertised as 3 days at home and 2 days at work. And some days, 4 days at home and 1 day at work. So there is some face-to-face interaction. But I think, certainly in the UK, has a terrible record of basically spitting on the working class. Nothing's changed since Victorian ages. And I think, as usual, we're the last. So as proud as we were, because, you know, it's democracy and, power, bring the power back to us. But actually, it's not that great. It's terrible. You can poke it. I'd like to be Swedish one day. John?
that's an extremely good point. So many good things come from Sweden. Not IKEA. That is kind of part of my point. In regards, if we want to kind of dig up the referendum again, but we might as well. One of the reasons why I wasn't in favour of leaving is not any kind of great love for the EU as an institution per se, but because the other options were a British working system, which, you know, you most of us know about anyway, just from paying attention to the news, but certainly you and I know about quite a bit, Dave, because we work in it. And we know what we have to do in order to, you know, prevent terrible things from happening, prevent terrible people from taking advantage. And that's just in a properly unionised workplace. Now, what you were seeing and everything else, and this is a classic example, what you're seeing so much so now of is ridiculously long hours. Other people working hours they don't even get paid for. Just a truly, you know, awful dystopian, frankly. I mean, I remember really being very, very drawn specifically, and some people might remember this, by an inside report that Channel 4 News did, where they reported from inside a factory that was owned by, not even Sports Direct this time, it was actually JD Sports. And honestly, it was like something out of a sci-fi film, where, you know, you see the beginning bit of the sci-fi film, and it's all about people kind of rising up and fighting back for their own humanity and destroying their masters. It looked like that, and it was genuinely one of the most frightening things I've seen for some time. And yet, those kind of work practices are exactly, you know, where we're at all the time now. One of the reasons why, you know, I never supported leaving is because I saw the people who wanted us to leave, and I knew enough about them to know that they're evil bastards. So,
I've reached a point, you know, and I don't think, I know I don't think people realise, and I understand that, you know, there's a huge element of I'm all right, Jack, pull the ladder up. Certainly since the 70s, that's just grown and grown and grown. That's sort of shrinking. But then we're waiting for the next generation who will not vote and couldn't care less about politics. And that is the biggest part, political party, I think. It's going to be bigger than the same political party called I Didn't Vote. The biggest political party in the UK and the US, they're called, and they're not even in politics because they don't vote, they're called I Didn't Vote. I think that's just going to supersede the people and pull the ladder up. And I think by 2030, politics and the way we work and the way we get things done will change drastically. I think that's accelerated during COVID. And I think politics and politicians need to have a good long look at themselves, whatever side of the aisle, and see how relevant they are. At the moment, they're relevant. At the moment, they're relevant to people of a certain age. But I said, as I said, 2030, I think people will say, well, I don't even a lot of people, young people, would you put a pulling cushion in front of them now and they couldn't care less, so, and wouldn't know who he was, and would go on to Netflix. So, you know, I've gone past the stage of getting angry. People will just be people. There's nothing we can do about it. But unless it affects them, if you're pensioned, if you on a pension and you've had a good pension in a working life and had a good job through and getting a good pension, you could care less what happens to anyone else, to be honest. John?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't wish to antagonise... Sorry, I don't know if you heard that bleep. That was me plugging my mouse in. Antagonise any kind of divisions of generation, because I don't think that's entirely accurate, but I do see what you're saying, and I do think there is an element of accuracy to the carelessness. I mean, I would go further rather than necessarily call it about pensions, this, that, the other. I would say it's more to do with home ownership, and what we, you know, as I say, I want to do a better thing than this, rather than just, you know, deal with it quickly or flippantly. But I do a deeper dive in this at some point. But, you know, what we're seeing at the moment, talking about, you know, whether or not so-and-so deserves this, or these people should have that, or we should be taxing, should we be taxing, you know, national insurance? No, we should be taxing wealth. And that's not being talked about. And it's not being talked about because that's the real base that the Tories care about the most. And it's not being talked about because it's also the base that Peter Mandelson cares about, therefore it's the base that Keir Starmer is not going to attack, because he lives in why you want people like that on your side anyway is another matter, but he lives in a rather deranged fantasy world of thinking that actually those people are going to be on the side of Labour at any point, or even, as I say, even if they should be. It's ludicrous, but then also it's a part of this wider system that's specifically designed, if I can say the word specifically designed to disempower us. That's entirely the point. It's entirely why it's here. You know, we're supposed to think this way. We're supposed to log off and watch Love Island. And I've talked about this for years. Again, this needs like a deeper dive, but I'll mention it now. You know, for years and years, I've been very resistant to the inability, the lack of desire people have to take life seriously, to constantly want to be kind of distracting themselves with petty, childish distractions and pathetic nostalgia, quite often for times they weren't even born in. And I think it's very, very dangerous for a number of reasons. But one of them is because, as we speak right now, you know, working people are discovering new ways to have our bodies broken by out of control psychopaths like Jeff Bezos. And the world is burning. And all you lot want to do is listen to fucking Heart FM. You know, it's appalling. But yeah, absolutely, there is an attitude of not. I'm not wanting to be involved because you're all right. I'm never going to... I mean, we've discussed this many times, Dave. You know, I'm not going to be one of the people that makes excuses for my own class all the time. We've done plenty of things wrong. And we screwed others over. We screwed ourselves over. And people need to face that. There are consequences to actions. But at the same time, there's also a way of getting out of that. And one of the ways, among other things, is to provide an interesting and decent vision that people can get behind, some kind of meaningful leadership, even if it isn't a leadership as in you must all follow me, but just kind of like a direction, a class analysis is what's needed, and a kind of basis for going forward. And actually, we've got a couple of stories, or at least one story I'm going to come up with a little bit later, which will address that. But yeah, I mean, that's kind of how I'd respond to that. But yeah, you go ahead.
Okay, as advertised earlier, we're going to go to a music break while we mess about with some microphones.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.tracksfm.org.
JT and the Big Family from 1989 and Moments Inside the Bootleg. Wasn't authorised. Signed up on Champion Records by Paul Oakenfold, would you believe? John, take it away.
Yes, one of those early bits of that fella's career. It's always interesting, that, isn't it, when you look back. I look back at certain publications or certain albums and stuff like that, and you think, that person who I didn't know who they were. It's like watching certain older films now. Like just randomly, folks, before we go on. The amount of films I've seen, and like I go back and I rewatch them, or haven't seen them, and you see like Rami Malek in a lot of them. You know, the guy that won the Oscar. It's kind of like, he was in Short Term 12. You know, which is a great film, by the way. And you just kind of go, oh, this guy's popping up, and it's really interesting to think that there's two types of ways that you see films like this. Either someone you've never seen before stands out considerably, and you're like, oh wow, this person's a really good actor. Or they do well enough, you know, they fit into the role, but you don't necessarily think much about them. And then like they're a big star and you go, I know you from somewhere. I remember this actually. Sorry, folks, just going on. I won't be long. I remember this with Jennifer Lawrence, because the first film I saw of her, and I think it was one of her first films, she starred in a film that's on Netflix at the moment called Winter's Bone, which is really good. And I've I like her as an actor, but I've actually yet to see her in a film I think is as good as her. Yet to see her act in a way I think.
I did not know you watched Netflix, John.
It's a long story. It involves a nephew and me borrowing his access.
All right.
And now becoming a major part of my life.
It is. It's so addictive. This watch what you want when you want it stuff. So yeah, wow, John Bowd watches Netflix, John.
There you go. That's a major revelation. The conservative columnists who monitor this show are now going to accuse me of rank hypocrisy for some reason.
Oddly enough, I don't think your traditional diehard Oxford type resident is a big fan of The Crown on there, which is quite revealing. A lot of it's fictitious, but I think they would be insulted by it. But oddly enough, the rest of the world loves it, and I think it's up to 82 million views at the moment. So, yeah, if you're disgusted by, you know, any of that fictitious stuff on the Royal Family, which I found quite entertaining, I thought it was a good, well-produced programme, I think the rest of the world loves it. What do you know? John?
Well, the thing is, I think people like drama, and I mean this not from a gender perspective, but purely from a personality and behaviour perspective. There's a lot of messy bitches in that family, let's be honest. So that's why people dig the royals, one form or another. Yeah, there's a lot of,
There's also a protection by the political party at the time. They were complicit in it. So... And it talks about Atwell being on drugs and things like that. I thought it was really good. I don't think they're British who produced it. I must find out. But they did it really well. I mean, you know, obviously Princess Diana Charles, that was quite publicised because she came out and broke the golden rule and came out and did an interview or interviews. And obviously the divorce and stuff. But all that stuff with Prince... Queen Elizabeth when she was young and that. It was amazing. It just put a different insight on it. And I don't think there were a British company who made it. But anyway, I digress.
We will, yeah. Just one more digression. I'm actually locked in a problem now where I've got 2.5 series or 3 series of Desmond's to watch before the 30th of September because they're going to take it down. So sorry if my research for the show has been a little bit lax recently, folks, but I've been kind of busy. I do want to see that.
Sorry, John, I was just going to say, I totally, you know, once you get hooked onto something, and it's, what do they call it, binge-worthy.
Binge-watching,
yeah. And I'm not a big TV fan, but I'm shocked. I mean, you could knock me off my Trax FM badger feet when you just said you watched Netflix. But anyway, carries on.
There you go. Do you know one of the things? I always scrupulously get some notes ready of some description because I'm too afraid to actually go live and just randomly do something. We should probably do that one week because if the worst case scenario is just us talking about fucking shows on Netflix, it could be worse. So it's not quite as the show is advertised, but I'm sure our long-term listenership would understand.
Well, I'm sure they feel the same way and we're not rigid in what we do and Trax FM is about doing what you... feel happy doing, John.
Yeah, that's true. We have one show a year, which is a Christmas show, where we talk about different Christmas music. Other than that, everything is deeply serious the rest of the year. Okay, so I've got one more slightly negative story and then a couple of positive ones from the world of work. So prisoners filling work gaps. A rather shocking story that caught my attention a few weeks ago, relating not only to working relations as they presently are, but also the continual failure of Britain, especially in relation to Brexit. The Guardian published a story of UK food firms beg ministers to let them use prisoners to ease labour shortage. And this story is written by Zoe Wood. Meat processors, among others, are saying they must have more day release workers, from prison, as they cannot find enough staff. Food manufacturers are desperate and pleading with government, in the words of the article, to be able to call upon prisoners to solve the labour crisis blamed on the double blow of Brexit and COVID. According to the paper, quote, the Association of Independent Meat Suppliers, which represents butchers, abattoirs and processors, said it had a call set up with the Ministry of Justice that would explore how its members could recruit more current inmates and ex-offenders. And as I say, this story is about 3 or 4 weeks old now, so it's probably... it's probably happened already. That the Rehabilitation officer at HMP Hollisley in Suffolk said said there was such a big demand for inmates, we've reached our quota. This is a quote. We've reached our quota and we're not allowed to let any more out to go to work, end of quote. While proclaiming this will be paid work for prisoners, in a manner of speaking paid, no doubt, they are also contacting charities for ex-servicemen and women to try and drum up staff. Numbers are still low, apparently, even with this in place. The food industry appears to be facing a severe recruitment crisis, and while the Home Office is apparently advising, whatever that is worth, that the UK domestic workforce should take priority, I heard that one before, this is running in line with a huge problem, getting HGV drivers, about 90,000 short, according to the paper. Do you know what? I checked that figure a couple of times, so I couldn't believe we're 90,000 people short of drivers. I didn't realise there was that many HGV drivers. That shows you what I know. This is apparently the cause of gaps in the supermarket shelves, of course. Also, Nando's have closed a bunch of restaurants and KFC have taken certain dishes off the menu because they presumably can't get hold of certain types of chicken. The British Retail Consortium and Logistics UK have written to government warning that consumers will suffer if government do not intervene. How very free market of you. The hospitality trade is also feeling the knock-on effect and struggling to find staff. Nothing to do with being notoriously a terrible sector that abuses and mistreats their staff, of course. Nothing to do with being a sector that underpays and fucks over their workforce in every possible way, steals their wages, steals their tips. No, it's actually just that you can't get enough people from a certain background in order to come. Basically, people will let you treat them like shit. Do you remember Byron years ago, actually, the posh burger joints that we have in, I know we have them in London, I don't know about anywhere else, where they employed a whole bunch of illegal immigrants, knowing perfectly well, and by the way, you know, no one's bashing illegal immigrants in this country, but I'm just saying they were employing people they knew to be illegal. And then when they started rejecting the crappy conditions they were being given and talking about unionising, they suddenly called it trusted to find that many of the people I've employed are actually not legally obliged to be here, but there you go. The British Poultry Council have warned that if the situation continues, we could see a shortage of turkeys for Christmas. So the BPC also said 1 in 6 jobs, that's nearly 7,000 roles, were unfilled as a result of EU workers returning home. They have asked government to relax immigration rules in the immediate term. Retailers are apparently increasing pay rates and introducing new driver training schemes, though through the British Retail Consortium are also calling for, in their words, government to play its part. Again, very free market. This part would include calls for increases in the number of HGV driving tests taking place and temporary visas to fulfil the present gaps that are there. Rather more concerningly, I've heard talk of them actually trying to rush HGV drivers through training, which I really, really don't think is a very good idea. Anyway, while never picking on prisoners nor attempts to aid them in any rehabilitation, certainly not on this show, but this story does illustrate just how low we have sunk and what the uber capitalist world we live in will do to avoid benefiting the very people that it actually relies on. Prison labour is the ultimate expression of capitalism, where slavery has theoretically at least been banned. Why, you should ask, is there a labour shortage? Well, were it not for marching into a great future of an independent Britain where all the slovenly youth would be given work no matter what, so that's what I thought we were going to get from Brexit, or all those long-term unemployed claiming they could not get work because of all the foreigners, or specifically the Eastern Europeans. Well, they've all gone home now, mate, so they don't have that excuse. It sort of seems like here is the cold, hard proof that all of this was actually total bullshit sold to us, sold to a very weak country with pitiful culture, still not coping with their utter irrelevance. So when any conservative or liberal politician or even commentator talks about bringing jobs back home, British jobs for British people and all of that, you know that in reality, they would literally rather use prison labour than employ people on proper contracts with decent wages. These greedy bastards cannot bring themselves to do anything at all that would benefit working class people. It is completely beyond their abilities. Gove, Johnson, Sunak, Patel, any of those people, they're all exactly the same. And so is Starmer, so is Phillips, so is West Streeting, any of those people. Totally beyond them to do anything good for working class people. The lack of class analysis in all aspects of this country at dangerous levels now because of this. Because if this had been in place for the EU referendum, for instance, everyone would have asked the right questions and seen through the likes of Johnson, Farage, Aaron Banks and Tim Weatherspoons, whatever his name is. They would have called them out, as many of us actually did at the time. Because think what you want to think this and think what you call themselves, thinking that employers give half a toss about the welfare of ex-offenders, ex-soldiers, or for that matter, anybody else. This is the panic that sets in when bosses are unprepared and will do anything to uphold the anti-worker structure of their system, not paying properly, not allowing control, anti-union do a better job than the present government. But there you go. Funny times in 2021, folks. Okay, Dave, do you want to feedback on that before I go on?
No.
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. You were cutting out a bit there, John. I think your internet connection is not letting you down. Not your microphone, oddly enough, because it sounds very nice. It's okay. It's fine. It came back. Yeah, it's just, I think it's going to get worse, John. We saw this. So what happens with political parties? So I'll give you an example. The Conservative Party in the 90s made some tax things go on. And obviously New Labour came in with a landslide. And although the economy got back on its feet, it was inherited by John Major's Conservative Party, his tax cuts in 93, 94, 95. And the New Labour benefited from that, and that's why we had a boom economy. And what will happen is the Conservative Party's rise in national insurance to fund a service that should be free anyway, and the next party that comes in will get the credit for it. That's how it works. That's how it works. And I would say both examples of what it is is both parties at the moment are so grey and boring and grey and boring that no one's going to bother watching them and couldn't care less unless something happens, something major like an invasion of a country, which is gone now. I think we've got a generation that just reject that. And we've got politicians that are grey, and they're grey deliberately because you're just not going to vote. And crap politicians coming on low turnout anyway. This is including Bill Clinton's Democratic Party, the Republican Party, the Conservative Party. A lot of these grey politicians come in on low turnouts, you know, and as I said, by 2030, most kids are going to say they're all effing grey anyway. I couldn't give a F. I'm going to sit and watch TV, Netflix with John, you know.
I'm going to sit and watch Desmond's repeats over and over again.
Yeah, they're going to say bring back, they'll write a petition to bring back Desmond's, but nothing else. Yeah. They'll campaign for faster broadband. They'll campaign, probably, to get rid of their student loans, which I think Biden's actually done quite well with that, and also the leaving Afghanistan, and what's happening over there. But oddly enough, that old man is not seen by the young people as grey. They see him as quite dynamic. He can't remember what happened yesterday, but they see him as quite dynamic. He's got so many followers on Facebook and Twitter. He's the oldest politician in town. And we can't get who we want to break an egg. John?
Well, I think that sorry, I didn't actually catch everything you said there because I dropped out for a bit. But, yeah, I think that it actually really shows how low we've gone down in our aspirations. Again, something that I think is all part of the plan. You know, that is the basis of capitalist realism, which every politician in this country from Margaret Thatcher onwards, every prime minister, I should say, has embraced and basically said, no, you can't change the system. You can just at best make it slightly less painful. That's all we can give you. Anything less than that, you know, anything more than that is not available. I think kind of low voter turnout is a major issue. I think it's a major issue in American politics and in British politics. And I do think that it has a knock-on effect. Because, again, it's a way of getting people uninvolved. That's the whole point. However, how do you assess that? Well, again, you know, we need someone who's willing to take an alternative, even if, you know, snotty people in the media are going to shout at you when you do so. Well, who cares? You know, have more. One of the many admirable things about Jeremy Corbyn is that he's got more backbone than any politician I've ever seen in this country. And we, you know, did ourselves a great disservice by turning our backs on him. But it's that kind of system. Right? Yeah, this is what they want. This disconnection is what they want. You need to demand more and keep demanding more. You know, even if you lose one fight. I mean, some of the stuff I've talked about tonight and the next two stories we're going to talk about as we go out, if we last that long, are going to be absolutely based on worker fightbacks. You know, this is the whole point. I've actually got a different strategy now, Dave. I think I should just come to your house with a megaphone. If you open the window and just put one of your microphones near it, and I'll just yell the fucking show into that, because I think that's probably the best way this is going to work.
Well, if you did that, I can add a nice effect and you'll sound like a reggae sound system.
You can put the echo. In tribute to Lee Scratch Perry, you can put the echo on the back. Yeah. I've never known anyone. If anyone out there can help us with this, I've never known anyone have as many problems with computers and sound as I have. Honestly, like your granddad does better than I do. You know, it's just,
You went back to Windows 10. It is Windows 10. And sorry to get technical. Windows 10 is updated and it's thrown out a lot of people's peripheral stuff that you just plug in and go. So what you're going to have to do is go to the manufacturer's website and find the original driver. Then go into system settings and tell your the stuff that used to work that now here's the other driver. That's all. I don't know what they've done. Sometimes you get some people who think they're too clever. And what you've done is you've just knocked out people. And it's not just you, John. I'm getting loads of stuff. From a lot of the musicians that I work with, they're saying a lot of their outboard equipment has been thrown out because of the Windows update. So you're right, it is Windows. Yes, I do think it's a conspiracy. John?
No, it's the only conspiracy relating to Bill Gates, let's be serious. Not a man, I mean, the Gateses and the Bezoses, I always actually laugh when people talk about conspiracy. It's like, they don't need a conspiracy, they fucking control everything. I mean, you know they do, you buy their shit. So why would they have, they don't need a conspiracy, be serious. Anyway, worker fight back at Pret. The chain Pret-a-Manger, or manager, well, fuck it, I can't speak French. Sorry, Martial. The chain Pret has seen a fight back recently by workers against having their bonus payments cut, with employees threatening strike action after temporary pay restriction was announced as permanent. The chain has rowed back in light of this resistance. It has not, however, reversed their decision to cease paying break times, meaning a worker on an 8-hour shift, including a legally required half-hour break, will see a pay cut of just over 6% per shift. The vast majority of Pret workers earn a basic pay legal minimum of £8.91 an hour. The down tools threat came after they were told a temporary cut in paid breaks would be permanent. I forgot to name the article, actually, that I found this in. But, again, it was actually in The Guardian. Guardian have been quite good the last couple of weeks on worker base. They're terrible in everything else, and they're horrible ideology, but they are quite good on certain worker stories. Anyway, quote, a service bonus linked to performance judged by a mystery shopper was ditched last summer and reintroduced in April of this year at 50p an hour, down from £1 before the pandemic hit. Workers were told last week that this change would also be made permanent, end of quote. Pret is one of the chains apparently facing severe economic pressure during the pandemic, as most stores are situated near businesses or town centre type areas for employees, and they have been closed for quite some time. The company ditched their dividend payments to shareholders in April and warned of material uncertainties, in the words of The Guardian, over whether they will continue to be a going concern. Now we see these pay cuts are part of the cost-saving program, and we have seen such things before. They have permanently closed 74 outlets in the UK in the last year, 22 of them in the US. I didn't even know they were in the US. While shareholders pumped in $185 million of additional funding into the company in the previous February, plus a further $100 million on standby in March to help keep it afloat, apparently. Since the worker threat to strike and a social media campaign, the company have climbed down on the bonus pay cut. A member of staff involved in the strike planned for, it would have been this month actually, told The Guardian that the new deal was a good improvement, but they were still weighing up whether to continue with their action as paid breaks had not been restored. Another worker said they had been moved to consider action as pay was becoming worse, just as the work was becoming harder, partly as a result of a subscription service that Pret introduced a year ago that enables members to get up to 5 coffees a day for a month, for a monthly £20 fee. 5 coffees a day. I mean, okay, £20 fee monthly. How the fuck do you sleep if you're drinking 5 coffees a day? Oh, you do? Okay, right. 5? We'll come back to that. Anyway, the employee said of this situation, quote, with the coffee subscription, we've had more work, more effort, more stress. People never stop going for free coffee, but our conditions as employees are going backwards, end of quote. All this while their wages are effectively being cut. Okay, watch out for this, folks. There's a lot of very sneaky wage cuts going on at the moment. Okay, it's fairly typical of the, you know, recovery or whatever the fuck you want to call it. But yeah. Anyway, Pret apparently used to have better working conditions than most in the hospitality sector. This employee that I quoted a minute ago confirms this. Ian Hodgson, the national president of the Baker's Food and Allied Workers Union, was also quoted in The Guardian saying the following. We call on Pret to think again. We can no longer sit back and allow these companies to boost their profits from workers' wages. It's awful to read that workers are facing even worse conditions as we try to get the economy back on track. After the pandemic, we are seeing a return to bad business as usual, and working people cannot and should not accept this anymore. We all deserve a better deal, and we will support the workers at Pret if the strike goes ahead. Some might be thinking that with all the financial problems Pret is having, that this justifies cutting workers' wages. But this is never, ever justified, everybody. If the company is not making the money that they were, this is an issue of management. The workers have not lessened their workload. And in fact, according to the testimonies like this given to The Guardian, the workload for Pret employees has increased. The failures of management in any company, like the wider failures of capitalism, must not be allowed to trickle down in their responsibility. Rather ironically, this is the only bloody thing that does trickle down in capitalism. Good to see an established union getting involved too. Always remember, though, when a company suggests temporary wage cuts or most of the time changes to working conditions, they cannot be trusted. So always fight this. Any union will tell you bonuses based on customer criteria are bullshit, and we need to end the world of relying on tips. Get proper pay structures in place. This is very, very long overdue. Still, good to see workers fighting back as ever, especially in sectors traditionally hard to recruit in. I will be keeping tabs on this and awaiting a nice picket line outside the local Pret shops in my area for sure. Okay, Dave, I've got one more story. Do you want me to go through this and then we'll feedback on both of them, or do you want to...
No, you go for it, John. You're on a roll, son. You're on a roll.
Well, I'm on a roll. I have internet connection. I have a microphone that works. Do not fuck with this. Just keep going. Okay, so I just want to throw a little bit of light on a rider-owned courier firm. As the pandemic started, loads of places were closing up and failing to provide their workforce with what they needed. So many looked for work elsewhere and found the precarious gig world was rather too welcoming to them. The hospitality sector was seriously shut down, so this bumped up the numbers working for Deliveroo, among others, you know, Deliveroo or Uber Eats or Just Eat or whatever, which resulted in an overflow of workers and reduced wages, apparently as little as £2 an hour for Deliveroo workers at one point. Three people who formerly worked for Deliveroo, Just Eat, etc., have now started their own firm in the Finsbury Park area of London called Wings. Wings, hold on a sec, I need some water, hang on. Ah, there you go, the broadcasting process. Wings is a rider-owned food courier cooperative that already has political support in the area from one of the local MPs. Wonder if you can guess who he is. the bloke who's always right and will be historically proven to be correct on everything, one Mr. Jeremy Corbyn. They presently deliver to the area Fridays and Saturdays, but they are looking to expand both delivery days and areas eventually. They are focused on the workforce having full control of their work environment. Riders have a say in which restaurants are on or off the platform. So basically, they have this kind of democratic control of their work environment entirely, you know, which is, if they're abused, for instance, in any way by certain people ordering stuff or certain restaurants, then they can take them off of their app or whatever you call it, off their platform. Okay. Riders are also involved in recruitment decisions for hiring new riders and members of the co-op. There are a lot of reasons for forming this, as a profile on Navarra Media's website detailed, starting with the problems and abuses of working for the existing corporations, most of which are well known, but worth noting a few specifics about them. Deliveroo, for instance, classes their riders and workers as independent contractors, so they can externalise the costs of employment onto the employees themselves. So it now becomes a responsibility of riders to get their own vehicles checked and insured, arrange criminal record checks and pay for all of it. Obviously, they are unable to work if these things are not done. All things that even after they are taken on by the rider with all the costs involved still do not guarantee any actual job. In comparison, a person featured in this story used to be a manager at Starbucks, and even when that company did all that for their employees. The founders of Wings were put into financial problems, in fact, by working for Deliveroo. It's one of the other things that United love. Wings are aiming to take all of this sort of work into management control and responsibility. For instance, they are using their small scale at this time in order to embark on all of these things at, if you like, a kind of base level, so that they can go forward as they grow, being this kind of company. Wings works like Deliveroo, but with a crucial difference. It pays riders a London living wage by regulating the number of riders on the platform. For now, there are just three, until more restaurants sign up, the aim being to have 80 to 100 riders within 3 years. According to one of the founders, speaking to Novara, quote, "Workers shouldn't have to suck up the vagaries of the market." I completely agree. "We're simply relocating the responsibility to where it should lie, the company's managers." End of quote. At the moment, they also reduce exhaustion, as riders have around 10 minutes between drop-off points. Also, the riders are local, so they know the area, meaning they are less likely to have accidents while rushing around on unfamiliar streets in different areas, looking at phone maps and that kind of thing. No doubt there will be a kickback from Deliveroo, etc., because they hate even the mildest competition or disobedience. One of the Wings founders recognises that regulation would solve the problem, but this will not happen under a Conservative government, and they recognise merely pulling out of the whole sector will not make it go away either, just relocate their infrastructure. Wings aims to build to resist the capital strikes that are likely to come from Deliveroo and the rest when regulation does kick in. Later on down the line. One of the Wings founders, a fellow named Rich, says in the Navarra Media article, "Deliveroo is a great infrastructure. You have these highly mobile people delivering packages from A to B, responsive and on demand. But the business model governing this infrastructure is extractive. It generates as much margin as possible to be skimmed off to shareholders. We're simply getting rid of that little extractive bit and closing the loop." End of his quote. He goes on to say it would be great to have a worker co-op that is also owned by the restaurants, totally owned within the community, as he puts it, creating an infrastructure to deliver whatever we need or want. He is confident that the community will stand by Wings in the face of delivery doing big discounts or whatever other tricks they're going to choose when they do actually notice this rider co-op, what they'll try and do to get that business back. It's very interesting to me how these folks see the need to build within the community, to create loyalty as part of their business plan, to actually serve the community in general. Just a last quote from the actual article. "Wings is offering a bold new vision, fundamentally rethinking the position of organised labour in the gig economy and transforming communities in the process. Only time will tell if Finsbury Park stands strong with the co-op." That's directly. Okay, so there's a link to Wings going to be in the show description this week, and I'm actually in the process of negotiating an interview with one of those ones of staff. Well, that's interesting, a really interesting idea. You know, it starts off small, has an idea about what it is that they want to do, and yeah, I'm quite impressed by that. Dave, what do you think on that one?
No, I I naively said that things would change after the pandemic, and stupidly I was wrong because it's bloody worse.
And something,
I think that something needs to be done. Something radical needs to happen. And again, the UK's not ready for it because it's too busy, I don't know, hiding behind flags and things.
Picking over the smouldering embers of a dying, dead empire.
Well, look at that GB news. It's terrible.
Why? Nobody else does.
I mean, I shouldn't really advertise it because, you know, but, you know, that compounds my argument how not important these people thought they were important, they were going to be important. We're going to appeal to all these people and they're all going to come crack. No, they're not. They're not. It's not going to happen. Don't bother. Who advises these people? Who actually says that we did a survey with all these youngsters and they're all going to... You didn't do any survey. You banked on something that is going or gone. I'm sorry, I'm not being disrespectful to our senior citizens. But they're going. They're ascending. Yep. And they're not being replaced by a heart. Anyway. And then again, some of the... I would say social media is taken away. And me and Pac-Man spoke about it when we went for a meal the other day. And I said it was more accurate. We would never have found out about George Floyd, for example. But he was right. He said the other side of it is you get some stupid people on there. So we need to sort of pluck away from that. But, you know, interestingly enough, the George Floyd atrocity, terrible thing that happened, was actually filmed and hit a lot of youth. And who felt strongly about it, very strongly about it. The nation's youth, the world's youth felt strongly about it. And maybe that's the way it's going, John. You know, that people feel strongly about the police and its brutality towards the Afro-American community. And it created a world, not an American response. It created a global response. So fingers crossed that we may be onto a right path here. But, yeah, until 2030, don't bother looking for anything that suits everyone and it's equal. John?
Yeah, I mean, I'd frame that slightly differently in that it is up to us to actually build this system. So I wouldn't say to people just be impassive and look for it. I wouldn't entirely agree with that. But... Yeah, I mean, I see what you mean. It is a system that requires a great deal of direct action.
Now, John, you're different. You go out and talk to people and interview them, you know, and that's good. And it's fantastic that there's people in the world like that, you know, and you get up and you arrange interviews and stuff. But, you know, and it's great, and that's why you're here. You know, but I'll go back to that GB News. That bothers me. I mean, who advised these people that it's going to be a massive success?
Well, it's not so much they advised, mate. They got people invest. You know, there are certain groups. I mean, okay, this is, we should, you know what, we should do this one week. Let's actually do a deep dive on this because there's a couple of things that go on there which interest me. One of them is, if you look at the attempt that little Lawrence Fox made not so long ago to run for London mayor, who funded him and why? And what's interesting is, again, you're dealing with people in the same way we're dealing with big conglomerates and companies that can afford to lose money. You're dealing with very, very rich, extremely right-wing, you know, psychotic, in my opinion, people who are able to lose a lot of money. And they want to put their stamp on the culture around them, and are obsessed in the same way someone like Paul Dacre at the Daily Mail has been obsessed for years and years with every little bit of culture that he can't do anything about. I mean, this is, let's be honest, you're dealing with the kind of man who tenses up when he sees a black man walking down the street, and even more so if he sees one holding a white woman's hand. And they know they've lost that battle a long time ago, but that's the kind of people you're still dealing with. And it's just an attempt to get involved in every facet, and to basically turn the only kind of politics any of us can access into all of this kind of culture war bullshit. That's what they're trying to do. So, yeah, there was that. There was also hubris based on the fact that they thought that they could, you know, that we're quite popular when we go on on question time. You know, it's actually the same, looking at it from the other side, the same kind of thing that made someone like Jess Phillips run for Labour leader. You know, she's in the media. The people in the media seem to like her. She's staggeringly egotistical. The people in the media seem to like her because whenever they got her on, she'd slag off Jeremy Corbyn in her own party and be really smug, just like they are. And then as a leadership, she dropped out in the first round because she had no fucking idea. She had no policies. She's absolutely worthless. And when you asked her a real question, she fell apart. GB News is kind of the same principle. You know, these people think they're good at one thing or another, think they're good at being basically antagonists in the wider culture. So I know we'll get an entire channel, you know, kind of dedicated to this antagonism. Well, no one wants to watch that channel. It's not interesting. It's not interesting on a mass scale like that anyway. So, you know, it's a mixture of hubris and the ability to drop that kind of... I mean, the thing that really surprised me about GB News, not surprises me, but I mean, this kind of, I think, kind of backs up part of my argument here, is the fact it's still on air. You know, why is it still there? Because they think somewhere down the line things will change and they'll become more successful. You know, not realising that actually the kind of people they're appealing to are the sort of people who probably prefer to read newspapers anyway, you know, like an older generation, as opposed to young people who don't give a shit about newspapers. Yeah, roughly speaking.
John, well, many thanks. Many thanks for gearing me up for my show and mentioning Paul Dacre. Thank you very much for that.
It's going to be a good one, folks.
Dave's going to be in a good mood. Many thanks, John. We'll chat next week and you're all geared up to go.
Maybe. Yeah, thanks, mate. Good to speak to you.
Cheers, John. Thank you.
Cheers, mate.
All the Rage with John Bowd. On www.traxfm.org.